Well, I promised you a rollicking good time, and I hope you agree that that is usually the case here on the Upland Nation podcast, but this one will be particularly so. We got a lot of topics to cover with Gundog magazine columnist Dave Carty, including a whole bunch of other interesting stuff related in various ways to bird dogs, including that last 10% in the training milieu, if you will. Dave Carty, welcome back to the Upland Nation podcast.
Good to be here.
And you have a rich, full life that includes all sorts of things outside of the bird dog world. And that's what I want to talk about first. Your newest book, Leaves on Frozen Grass, seems to be tripping the triggers, pardon the pun. It's not a dog book per se. It's got dogs in it, but it's not about dog training or bird hunting per se. But it right. seems to be getting the critics and the market a little bit excited. Tell me a little bit more about all of that, you know, the book writing process, all the things that I can't do that you do so well.
Well, I, you know, it was never as a, as I decided I wanted to be a writer when I was 13, for several things that sort of coincided in my life at that point and pointed me in that direction. But I always wanted to write for magazines. And even though when I look back at papers I wrote at a very young age, I was almost always writing stories and fiction. It never really occurred to me to actually write a novel until I got into my 30s. At this point, I was a professional writer writing for magazines, largely outdoors, but not entirely. And started writing novels, most of which were bad at first, but that's how I learned. And then I wrote Leaves on Frozen Ground 2 or 3 years ago. Went through the normal hell that all new writers go through or new novelists, even though at that point I'd written 4 or 5 novels, you know, getting all kinds of rejections, and finally got it published. And, you know, it's gotten some really good feedback from people. That's been really gratifying to see how people have reacted to it. And more importantly, I mean, what I learned with the first novel I wrote, which I think I was 35 at the time, 36, something like that. And again, it was a terrible book, but I just loved it. I just really loved it. So that is basically where I'm heading from here on out. I'm not, you know, I don't have any illusions about becoming rich and famous at this, but it's something I really, really enjoy and put my heart into. And like you said, the book is Leaves on Frozen Ground is not about bird dogs, but it has definitely got a prominent part for a couple dogs in there. So I think anyone who likes dogs would like the book.
Well, and
anyone who likes a family drama would like the book.
Well, and I apologize. I called it something else, but it is Leaves on Frozen Ground, and it's right. available. Where will we find it if we want to go out and buy it today?
You can buy it on Amazon, and you can also get it at the publisher. It's a small press in Toronto named Guernica Editions. I'm in the Guernica World Editions, but you can, the simplest way is just to go to Amazon.
Amazon to find yep. Leaves on Frozen Ground.
You can get an ebook and a regular print edition.
And you know, you said something that I did experience. So we have one more thing in common besides all those other things we'll talk about. And that is, at some point you just say, I got to get this thing out of my system. I did, and it was soon after you and I first talked when I was doing Field and Stream Radio. I quit the radio business so that I could write a dang book.
That's a big jump.
Oh, well.
That's a bigger jump than I took.
Yes and no. I mean, it's like everything else. I was doing all sorts of other things at the time anyway, so I shed 2 part-time jobs to take another part-time lower paying job. But,
yeah.
but you know
Sounds
how
like
that
me.
Works.
Yeah, do I ever. I mean, I have this, I am, you know, unfailingly tuned in to doing the work that makes the least amount of money.
It must be in our DNA. You know, my mother was a teacher. She did it for love. She would have done it for free. And I think it just comes to us.
Yeah, my mother was a disc jockey, and she did that for the same reason.
Oh, my God. Well, give us the gist of the story. And I don't mean don't give anything away, but tell me what you're trying to convey with this story.
Well, the story is around Celine and Gaston Valencourt, and they are a, well, Gaston is a French Canadian heritage. Celine is the blonde, blue-haired, I'm sorry, not blue-haired, blonde, blue-eyed woman who went to college in a very WASPy school in Minnesota, played on the volleyball team, and meets this guy, and they get married. And basically the story is set on the south shore of Lake Superior. It is based on the town of Bayfield, Wisconsin, where I spend a lot of time. But because I wanted to move the geography around, I called the town Port Landing. So I can move it around and nobody can accuse me of not knowing where this or that is, because I'm making up the name of the town. But and over the course of the book basically is a chronicle of their relationship over the course of the last recession. Now, this was written before this new recession hit us, so it would apply now too, but it was set in 2008 and 2009, 2010. And they have some, the story basically is around the relationship between Celine and Gaston and their son Edmund, and some really tragic events that happen in their life that they weather. And not necessarily for the good or the bad, that would be giving too much of the story away, but the story is all about how these three people deal with the tragedy that happens in their lives.
You know, I'm only this far into the book, and already I am worried about that kid.
Yeah, 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 that's, I'm not going to make you feel any better by telling you what's going on.
Okay,
so.
Thanks.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's, you know, go ahead.
That kid, you know, I really don't write stories based on my own life, but to a large extent, the way Edmund grew up is the way I grew up, basically roaming through the woods with my dogs, you know, looking for animals.
Yeah, so, and they say every novel is autobiographical to a degree, and it's only
up to a degree,
a matter
yeah.
of degree. So, looking forward to finishing it up. Everybody else who wants to find it, Leaves on Frozen Ground, go to Amazon, just type that in, and you'll find it right like that.
You sure will.
Let me give you just one excerpt from one review. Insightful throughout, at times profound. Leaves on Frozen Ground is the work of a fine writer and keen observer of the human condition. Yeah, I can't argue that one dang bit. So keep up the good work. And
well, I appreciate it.
We'll be revisiting this topic in a related manner later on in the discussion. But first, I promised everybody we would help them get across the finish line with their dog training. And your most recent Gun Dog magazine column is about something that just it is a pet peeve of mine. It perturbs me, and I've had four dogs get to this point, and I finally got a fifth dog that I think is going to get over. You talk about the last 10% of the training process, I guess. Tell me, explain what you mean by that.
Well, the best way to give it a capsule description is I had a roommate that lived with me here after I built this house. For 16 years, he was just a great guy. Unfortunately, Jack died a few years ago, but he used to talk about the completion factor, and it's exactly what you just said. It's the last 10% of training, and I think it is really crucial part of training any dog. It is the most important part because it's where you take what you have shown the dog how to do and reinforced, and then put him in the paces in a stressful situation repeatedly until he starts understanding that even when he's in a stressful situation, even when he is distracted or she is distracted, even when there's something else he or she really wants to do, he still has to abide by the rules that you have trained him to abide by. And it's so much easier to not go to that stage because this takes some logistics. You got to set things up. You have to anticipate what might happen in the field. You have to anticipate that your dog is not going to obey you and then what you're going to do at that point. But doing it this way means that you don't have any major, or at least you have fewer. I can't say you'll never have them. You'll have fewer major blow-ups when you're actually on a hunting trip.
I am thinking of my first career. I mentioned it to you earlier, and that is the music business, where nobody does a show without a dress rehearsal.
Right.
And it, in a lot of ways, it's a dress rehearsal. And I'm like I said,
that is a perfect example.
I'm to that point with my wire hair flick right now. He is right there on almost everything. And in fact, I'll talk about that a little bit down the road here in this podcast. By the way, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. That's Dave Carty, columnist for Gundog Magazine. I'm Scott Linden. All right. So why is it most of us settle for good enough instead of pushing that last bit?
I think the reason why for the majority of people, there's a certain percentage of people who are just lazy. And if I were to not train my dogs to that level, knowing what I know about training dogs, you could have a valid excuse for calling me lazy, but that isn't what I do. I think most people just are not aware of it.
Yeah.
They give you an example, for instance, real simple example. And this applies to any dog. So you teach your dog to sit. You're in your living room. It's quiet. There's no distractions. You teach him to sit. You give him a biscuit or whatever little treat you want to give him. And he sits constantly. He does a great job. He knows that he wants that treat. There's no distractions. So you take him out for a walk. And all of a sudden you're walking somewhere. And there's all these scents out there. There's these things he wants to explore. There's other dogs, there's wind, there's whatever. And you tell him to sit, he ignores you. And you think, well, he just did this a minute ago in the house. Well, of course he did. That's because he had some incentive to do and he wasn't being distracted by anything. But as soon as he has distractions, then he doesn't do the command that you've trained him to do. And in my opinion, your dog isn't completely trained. He's partially trained if he haven't been run through that stress, call it, you know, stress therapy, call it whatever you want, mm-hmm. but he needs to go through that to understand that regardless of what is happening in the outside world, when you are hunting and when you give him a command, he still has to obey that command.
You know, and you mentioned some of the things that I've advocated for years, and the first one is you got to go to different places because not just because yep. they're different places, but because there are different sets of stimuli in all those places that do exactly what you say, distract the dog. The other thing you talked about was creating your own distractions, taking everything up a notch, raising the bar, if you will, in various yeah. ways. I'll give you a perfect example just for everybody else because I'm being a little selfish here. Flick is, like I said, almost steady to wing shot and fall. So yesterday I crammed 3 practice pigeons into 1 bird launcher because the one thing we haven't simulated enough of was a covey flush.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, he's ready for this. I'm pretty sure he is. But we went back to the, you know, some other familiar things. The setting was a familiar setting. Everything else was the same. The only difference was more birds came out that time. What are some of the other examples of what I'll call raising the bar a little bit that would help us get that dog polished?
Well, that example you gave is a very good one, by the way. It's one I use myself, although I typically will use 2 traps or sometimes even 3 and flush the birds sequentially because, like you, I train my dogs to be steady to wing shot and fall. So that is a very good one. You know, there's all kinds of things you can do. We're not going to talk today about the process of getting a dog up to a reasonably good level of, say, steadiness or recalling.
Yeah.
Let's just assume that your dog is already there. Now you need to up the game a little bit to stress him out a little bit. And I don't mean stress him out in a bad way. I mean just to get him excited so that there's something they're concentrating on that you need to draw their attention back away from. You want to start that gradually. You don't want to go out, you know, and set your dog up and whoa, and then, you know, call up a local brass band to march circles around your dog. You want to start that out low. So you may say, okay, the first thing you're going to do is, as you mentioned, which is a very good thing to do, take them to a different place. That might be the lowest level that you can stress the dog beginning with. So you take them to a different place because when the way dogs think, something I learned from George Hickox years and years ago, when you take a dog to a different area, they assume that the rules in the former area no longer apply. Don't ask me why they think that. They just do.
Well, we do too. Again, back to music. I made a lot of money playing Oktoberfests. And and before those people in Nevada said it, for years we would say, what happens at the Oktoberfest stays at the Oktoberfest. And I'm not going to go into any more details. But
yeah, well, I'll use my imagination.
Those places
after
are
Oktoberfest.
After
all, you had a tuba.
So new locations are Oktoberfest for your dog.
Yeah, that's really good. That's exactly right. So say you're teaching your dog, let's just say you want your dog to be steady. So you've been training him in the backyard. Well, you take him to somebody else's backyard. You drive him out and you put a pigeon down or whatever bird you're using, and you teach him to be steady in a different location. Typically, it doesn't take a lot to do that, but it also typically the first couple times you flush that bird, the dog will break because it's a different location. You have to correct them. They start realizing, oh, okay, same rules. So the next thing you might do is take your dog out and this is something I would do here, for instance, take my dog out to where I know there's cows or horses. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Bird dogs are fascinated by cows or horses. You got to ask them why, but they just have this, some dogs have this endless fascination with livestock. So you take them someplace where there's livestock, same deal. And then one of the biggest distractions for dogs is having other dogs running around while they're on point and trying to hold steady. So if you have two dogs or you can borrow somebody's, you take your dog, you set them up, you whoa them, you know, in front of the bird, and you turn loose another dog. And as soon as the dog breaks, you correct him and you bring him back, and you don't flush that bird until he's steady there. And so you gradually increase that. You know, and then of course at any time there, if you've already probably been adding gunfire, other distractions, people yelling, things like that. It's typically a 2 or 3 week process to do that, but it is basically bomb proofing your dog.
You know, you use livestock as an example, and a lot of folks will use bomb proof as an example of a horse that's real steady too. Another thing that I've used a lot is distance. For example, you do what you just described, the scenario of your dog, you whoa that dog, he knows he's in the scent cone, he's holding that point because he knows he's expected to do that. Well, the first time I introduce another dog, it's way far away. And
that is a good point. That's a good point, Scott. I should have mentioned that, but yes, that's the right way to do it.
And that goes for gunfire and even proximity to pointed birds, for example. You want a dog to be steady. You know, one way to get him steady is make sure he's whiffing that bird from 12, 15, 25 yards away if you can. Mm-hmm. So all of those things add up to a more finished dog. But everybody has their own definition. And I ask this on Facebook a couple times a year. How do you define a finished dog? What does Dave Cardy's finished dog look like in the field?
Yeah, well, so here's the interesting thing about that. So when I was doing training as a part-time pro, which basically meant for about a dozen years, I trained dogs during the summers because I was hunting all fall. I didn't want to train dogs then.
Got your priorities right.
And I started off training dogs and recommending to people that they train the dogs the way I trained mine, which was basically, in my opinion, completely broke dog. It was steady to wing shot and fall. It was force broken to retrieve if it wasn't natural retriever, which very few pointers are. It would recall immediately on the whistle or on a tone if I wanted to train it to do that. And then later, after all that training was done, I would teach it sitting and healing. Actually, mm-hmm. healing was mm-hmm. would usually wrap up my major training program and eventually sitting. Now I considered that a completely finished dog because that's what I like to hunt over. What I found out after a few years is, although I trained a number of dogs like that for people, virtually no one was interested or capable of keeping the dog at that level because it doesn't require a lot of expertise, but it does require some, and it requires some consistency. You can't you can't just go out and say, okay, my dog's studying the yard, he's doing anything great, and then the dog goes out in the field on an actual hunt and busts a covey, and you let it go. You have to correct the dog. You have to show it. I mean, that's the ultimate stress for a dog, is an actual hunting trip. And the training extends until the dog is getting in that field. And very few people will do that. They would rather shoot the bird than keep the dog steady. Mm-hmm. So I kind of backed off a little bit on that. I would certainly be happy to train any dog to that level when I was training if people wanted it. But what I started recommending is, for instance, rather than steady to wing, shot, and fall, I would have the dog basically steady to wing and breaking at the shot, which is what a dog naturally will do anyway. And that made it, it accomplishes two things there. It keeps the dog safe, so he's not running out while you're shooting. And yet it keeps the dog steady so you can approach the bird. Mm-hmm. So it's much simpler to keep a dog at that level for most people. And then I would basically say, look, you know, I would give them the pros and cons in force breaking, which is actually a thing I don't particularly enjoy, but it's something I want my dogs to do. I would give them the pros and cons, which basically came down to, look, my experience is you should force break this dog. I don't see very many pointing dogs, even though I know your breeder told you the dog is a natural retriever. I see very few that are. I would recommend this. But if you don't want to do it, we can wait. He may come around. And about half the people would say, let's wait. So that would be more my standard for the average hunter, a dog that's steady to wing, breaks at the shot, a dog that's not necessarily force broken, but absolutely a dog that recalls every time when you blow the whistle or give him whatever recall command you want to give it to, a dog that will heal, which I think is a really underrated command. So pretty simple, basically, healing, recalling, steady to wing, and that's basically it. And then you've got a dog that's reliable and confident that you can hunt over.
You know, there's a term out there that I haven't heard for a while, actually, but some of the old timers in particular, really, they'll describe a dog as an honest dog. And I've always interpreted that this way. I have expectations for that dog. Does that dog meet my expectations? If he consistently meets those expectations and the realistic expectations, then he's an honest dog.
Yeah.
So it's a match, isn't it, Dave, between what the dog is capable of and what you want the dog to be capable of, if you will.
Exactly. Everybody's going to have a different idea. I mean, the more you hunt, just like anything else, your ideas on what you want in your dog evolve. I started off with pointing dogs when I was 12 years old. I got my first dog from my dad. It was a Brittany. But when I got moved to Montana when I was 30, I had the idea, like awful lot of people and a lot of my friends still do, that because I was hunting prairie birds, Huns and Sharptails primarily, that I needed a big running dog to chase those birds. As I found out, I did not, and I've evolved to where I pretty much want a dog on the prairies that's, you know, 200 yards. Mm-hmm. Might be bigger than that sometimes, might be less. I don't really need all that extra range. And that is the evolution of what I've decided I want to do. So an honest dog for me is a dog that hunts within the range that I want it to hunt, which is basically something that's determined during the breeding. It's very hard to train a dog to do that consistently. Mm-hmm. And if the dog is also a team player where he checks in and is clearly hunting with me and not against me, that is what I consider an honest dog.
Amen to that. I agree 100%. I'm curious because you mentioned this in a previous conversation as well. And I've made a study of sharp tails and made a few bucks writing about it. As a result, thank you everybody who did that for me. But why have you tightened up your dog's range, or why have you been satisfied with a tighter range on your sharp tail hunting dogs?
Well, a couple reasons. Because I hunt, you know, my hunting here season here is starting 4 days, Tuesday, yeah. And I'll be hunting blue grouse just about every day for the first month of the season, and then they disperse. Then I hunt Huns and sharp tails. When I'm in Montana hunting, which is most of the time, I'm hunting Huns and sharp tails 2 or 3 days a week, mostly Huns, but some sharp tails as well. And I've been to places where I hunt a lot of sharp tails. Okay. So you have a dog, you get a, you know, this, you know, big ass pointer that runs at 1,000 yards that has been field bred to do that because that's what it was bred to do. That's the game it was bred to play. And the dog's going to find you birds. There's no doubt about that. But the first objection that I have to that anymore is, number one, it can take a long time to walk 800 to 1,000 yards for a dog on point. Those birds are not going to hold forever. Hungarian partridge in particular are very spooky birds. Sharp tails can be that way even more so later in the season.
Yeah.
And they're just not going to hold forever. And the other thing is just pure selfishness. Look, I spend when I train my dogs, I give them an adult dog. It takes longer with puppies because they don't mature as quickly. But with an adult dog, I'll spend 4 or 5 months working twice a day, 6 days a week to get that dog where I want it. By God, I want to watch him work. I want to see my dog while I'm hunting. I don't want to just turn him loose and look at my GPS to try to figure out where he was. I want to watch. That's what's fun for me.
Well, and everybody else, you know, I survey my TV viewers every year, and they tell me that's why they go hunting. So I get it. I mean, I'm all about that. So
I mean, why would you? It's like taking your horse for a ride and turning the horse loose and figuring out where he went.
I just have never heard it so aptly described. But yes, you're absolutely right. Hold that thought, because we're going to talk a little bit more about kind of the more general stuff like that. Your assignment during this break, Dave Carty of Gun Dog Magazine. By the way, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden. Your assignment, Dave, is to ponder what you like most about hunting and dogs. So if you hold that thought, we'll be right back after a couple breaks.
Okay.
And the first one involves my good friend, Dr. Tim Hunt. He's a veterinarian. He has formulated a whole bunch of great dog foods. He calls them Dr. Tim's. And if you want to learn more about them, drtims.com is where you learn all about his incredible variety of formulas for various dogs at various stages in their life and what they're doing. I'm particularly favorable to the Momentum formulation. It's a little bit higher protein, a little bit higher fat, and it does flick a lot of good. If you'd like to try some of Dr. Tim's dog foods, you can always order online, and when you do, you'll get 30% off your first order if you use the code UPLANDNATION. They'll deliver according to your schedule. Just like all those other guys who may support organizations you don't want to support, Dr. Tim knows his stuff. Learn more at drtims.com. And speaking of online, my good friend Jack Homa at ESP, Electronic Shooters Protection, has been protecting my ears electronically for decades now. Learn more about the variety of products he has that will keep you hearing even if you're not listening to your spouse. Learn more at espamerica.com. Get fitted locally. No need to go far away. There's an audiologist in your town that he has a relationship with, and they will take care of it right there in the privacy of their office, not behind the counter at a sportsman show where everybody's gawking at you. Learn more at espamerica.com. And that's all the break you get, Dave Carty, with Gun Dog Magazine. We've been talking about the last 10% or the final furlong in the horse race. You really got me going on this one because it is so hard to cross the finish line. And it's what I like most, you know. I bore you with my music stories, but again, you know, you can't play 90% of a concerto and then go home. You have to play the last 16 measures. And you're talking about basically the same thing, aren't you?
It's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. It's the completion factor. You have to finish the job you started.
And I think when you first were taken to school on this concept, it was in another industry. Your roommate was in something else where if you did not finish the job, something bad was really going to happen.
Well, he was a carpenter.
Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't finish the job. He didn't get paid.
Well, that's a problem right there.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but also, the snow probably would come through the rafters or something worse.
Yeah. So, no, I built my own house, and it was exactly, I mean, it sometimes it's just, you're so close to getting finished and you just want to drop and forget about it. But that last bit is what makes you stop worrying years later and makes you glad that you did it.
Yeah. And there is a little bit of a pride factor there, and hey, okay. All right. I'm not going to go there, but you know, my feelings about field trialers and hunt testers, you know, some people go way too far in that world. And it gets way beyond pride. But let's skinny it back down to the most important stuff in our lives at this moment, besides your new novel, Leaves on Frozen Ground, and that is dogs and hunting. I mean, you just said you're about ready to set out on a month of blue grouse hunting.
Yep.
I mean, yeah,
pretty much my mornings.
I love that idea. I wish I could pull it off. What is it about that kind of stuff that really gets your juices flowing?
You mean what is it about hunting or the particular birds or the whole picture?
Probably the whole picture. And then I'm intrigued by blue grouse too, because we actually have some, and I've made a promise to go at least once this year.
You know, I don't understand exactly. My father was a hunter, but he was not very, you certainly would not call him passionate about it. He was pretty much an armchair guy, but I give him a lot of credit. He saw that I loved it, and I don't understand why it was I was always drawn to the outdoors, but I can never remember, as far back as I can remember, 6-7 years old, not being wanting to be outdoors, camping, hiking, you know, playing, you know, running up and down streams, chasing minnows and frogs, looking for animals. And then when I discovered hunting and fishing, that's where all that energy went. And I was one of these, what you would call an outdoor geek. You know, I wasn't always real popular in school, but I spent all my time reading Outdoor Life magazine and among a million comic books and everything else that I read in those days. So I just wanted to live that lifestyle, and I was infatuated with it before I ever actually got to do it very much. I was just in love with the idea, and it's never really changed for me. And then getting bird dogs that's what the sport becomes about. I mean, it's hard not to talk in cliches. I wouldn't go hunting if I knew I couldn't kill a bird, but killing the birds is about the least important part.
Well, that's deep philosophy from Jose Ortega y Gasset. But I agree, but carry on, because I think I know what you're going to say next, and I want to see if it does come true.
Well, it's just the different birds, they're all different. They all have their own places they live, their own personalities, a way of hunting them. There are no birds that I've ever hunted, at least, that don't live in beautiful places. I mean, bluegrass cover is gorgeous. Places where sharptails and huns live is beautiful. The place I hunt rough grouse in Wisconsin is gorgeous. So I love it all. I really enjoy going out with friends, the friends that I hunt with who are, you know, really no bird dogs. And you just fall into this easy rhythm of hanging out with your friends and watching the dogs. And we talk about the dogs and we talk about the birds. And, you know, we probably bore the cat piss out of anybody else listening to us, but we just love it. We never get tired of it. We never get tired of talking about it. We never get tired of I never get tired of watching a good dog run. I never get tired of watching them work a bird and slam on a point. It's just as exciting to me as it was 50 years ago.
I love it.
So, yeah.
And it's so true. And you know, the funny part is, and perhaps this is why the podcast world has grown exponentially, and that is, when we can't do it, we love talking about it.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly who I am. I'll talk your ear off about a lot of things, but man, if you're going to get me started talking about bird dogs, bring a sleeping bag.
Have you had one magical dog that's changed your life, Dave Carty?
Boy, I'll tell you, I started getting Elihu English pointers about 11 or 12 years ago from my breeder in Bayfield. and he and Mark and I have become really good friends. And I've had some good dogs and some not good so dogs since then. And it seems like every dog that I, every English Pointer of the Elihu strain, which is a big difference, seems to be better than the last. And the young dog I have now, my youngest dog is now 4. I'll actually be getting it, hopefully, Mark told me there's some breeding coming through this fall, so I'll hopefully have another puppy next spring. But the pup I've got now is tiny. She's 40 pounds soaking wet as an English Pointer. And if I could clone her, I would have dogs like her for the rest of my life. She's just everything I want in a dog. She's got the right range. She's got the right attitude. She's smart as a whip. She's got a ton of style. She's just the happiest little dog you've ever seen. She's so thrilled to be out hunting. It would be hard to improve on her. I mean, if I can just keep getting dogs like her, I'm going to be a happy camper.
So here's the question for all of us who are always, at least in our minds, shopping for new dogs, even if our spouses haven't given us permission yet.
Yeah.
You hear that, honey?
Ask me why I'm not married.
Yeah. Well, we don't get me started. But so the potential puppy that you're hoping might develop out of all of this relationship with your reliable breeder, has it got some of the same genetics as your current dog?
I think the father will be using the father's sperm, so it will be the same father as my first two English Pointers, but a different mother.
Okay, but
that's my understanding.
And here's what I get out of that. And this is a lesson for a lot of us, but you have so much faith in this breeder and for good reason, you have experience, but you're putting a lot of faith in the breeder himself, as opposed to you're parsing out the pedigrees and the genetic aspect. God. Is that how important really is that? You're the expert on this kind of stuff to most of us.
Well, I am. Let me tell you, I am not an expert on breeding and pedigrees.
Yeah,
I can basically get through one. I'd be scared to death to try to produce a good litter of dogs. My philosophy, my talent, first of all, has always been training dogs. Mm-hmm. I've never bred any, and I know people that do, and they do just fine. But my philosophy has always been, find a breeder that you can trust who breeds good dogs, and then keep buying dogs from him. And that's what I've done with a couple different breeders in my life, and it's worked out very well for me.
And me too.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you made the point. You put the cap on what I was kind of getting at, and that is, we'll never know as much as those guys know about how to make dogs.
I wouldn't even begin to guess. Mark, my friend, Mark Wendling has forgotten more than I will ever know about breeding dogs. The thing about this, that the reason more than anything that I've stayed away from breeding myself, because number one, it's an art and a science. It takes years and years and years to get good at it, to get really good at it, where you're producing consistently good dogs. And I have absolutely become convinced with my experience as a dog trainer that you can eliminate 90% of the problems you will ever have training a dog if you just get a dog that's well-bred to begin with. That makes all the difference in the world.
And when all is said and done, the price of a good dog versus the price of a bad dog is infinitesimal, isn't it?
It's nothing. I mean, it's nothing. You know, there are dogs these days that are going for $2,000 to $3,000. And if it's a really good dog, that's 200 bucks over the course of that dog's life. That's nothing. It will save you so much aggravation and so much hard work, and you'll get so much more enjoyment. It's worth paying the going rate for a good dog from a good breeder. And good breeders are not going to sell their dogs cheap. That ain't going to happen. You want a good dog, you're going to pay for it.
But you want a good dog.
You should want a good dog.
I mean, it sounds obvious, but there are people who will, they'll quibble over $200.
Yeah, go figure.
Yeah. All right. So, I can't leave a guy like you and this topic. We're nowhere near done, Dave Carty. By the way, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, Dave Carty with Gundog Magazine and his new novel, Leaves on Frozen Ground. Without asking you, what is the most important dog training mistake most of us make? What do people bring their dog to you to fix?
Yeah, well, they used to bring them for a lot of things. Clearly what we've been talking about not finishing, I think I would honestly have to say that is one of the big ones for sure. I mean, your dog is not going to get where you want it until you factor in the completion factor and do the last 10% to get that dog where you want it to go. There's a lot of other little things that you probably don't want to do. For instance, if you're training a pointing dog, this is different from retrievers and spaniels. I've never owned retrievers. I've owned spaniels and trained them. You don't want to teach the dog to sit before you train it or before you start going into regular training. But if you do, it's not the end of the world. Basically, what dogs will revert to what they, when you're teaching a dog a new command, for instance, whoa, and the dog does not understand the command, which he won't the first few times you show him what you want him to do, they'll revert to what they know. And if you teach the dog to sit, then he will start sitting. That's basically the way that works. It's not the end of the world. You can go and I've had to do this with a lot of dogs. You just go tell the dog to whoa, he sits, you go pick up his butt and you set him up and eventually they get it. But you can save yourself that if you just wait until you're through with the major training program and teach the dog to sit last, which, by the way, is a command I think is very helpful, and I teach all my dogs to do it. But I do it at the end. I think it's a mistake not to train a dog to heel, and I see very little of this in, you know, the what literature I'm still reading about training dogs. Very few people talk about this. I think for a pointing dog, it just is one of those things that makes your life a lot easier in the field. You're out in the field. You want to heel your dog away from a bunch of cows that it's interested in, or a snake that may be over someplace, or you want to walk to a new field, you don't want your dog hunting. Heel is a command you want to use, and it's an easy command to teach, and very few people do it. Yeah. I think that's a mistake.
I agree 100%. It's one of those skills, if you will, that that will come in handy, and even in real hunting situations. For example, putting a sneak on a duck through the brush on a riverbank or something like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Yeah, you bet. You bet.
So it does help a lot, and you're absolutely right. And there are ways to train that pretty easily. I don't know. Do you use a wonder lead or anything like that, or what do you use to teach heel?
Yeah, well, yeah. I'll tell you what. Rick Smith made a killing on the wonder lead. I use what's called a pigging string. Yeah. The same thing.
Yeehaw!
If you go to a ranch and supply home store, which we have a lot of in Montana, you can buy a pigging string, which is what calf ropers use to tie up the calves. And it works, but actually Rick's wonder lead is designed for that. It works extremely well. And so I essentially use a wonder lead. I just buy it at a different place, but
yeah,
you can also, and what works equally well is a pinch collar.
Yeah.
They both work, but the wonder lead or a piggin string is what I use, 'cause they're just real convenient. They work really well.
They are. They're handy, and I'm a believer. But speaking of that sort of thing, when Dave Carty goes into the field for a blue grouse hunt or a sharptail hunt or something like that, number one, exactly where are you going? And number two, seriously, what would you not leave the truck without in terms of critical gear, two things?
You would not believe how much grief I get from my friends for all the stuff I carry, but I always have stock reply. I tell guys, look, you haven't had to carry as many dogs out of the woods as I have. So I do kind of go overboard. First of all, I have a full supply of water, and this is true no matter where I go. I carry a lot of water. So I'll have, if I'm going to be hunting over one dog for 2 hours, I'll carry half a gallon of water. If I have two dogs, I'll carry almost a full gallon.
Yeah.
I'll have a first aid kit that's got basic stuff to get my dogs out of the woods. That's not where I'll put my staplers or anything like that. But I will have some patches. I will have tape. Mm-hmm. I will have a little bit of antiseptic, some things that I can use to just patch up the dog if he's badly hurt, to get him to the truck where I have another first aid kit to get him to the vet.
Yeah.
Then I will, I have something else that I haven't used yet, but eventually it will come in handy. It's a little harness. I can't remember where I got it, but it's a little harness that you can wrap over your shoulders that you can put under the dog to help carry a dog out. You know, a 40-pound dog, even a small 40-pound dog, can get pretty heavy after you've been carrying it in your arms for 2 miles. So this strap, this little harness, weighs practically nothing. And I carry that, you know, in the back of my pack. I carry an extra raincoat. I carry a vest because it's cold up in the mountains. You know, I typically don't carry that many shells. I might have 6 or 8 shells. There might be a few more. I carry a lot of stuff. My pack, my hunting vest typically weighs about 25 pounds.
You know, I've been messing with mine, getting it fine-tuned for this season. And yeah, I bet mine's right up there, especially when you add the water in there. And boy, oh boy, you're absolutely right. Carrying that much water is, you know, I found in years past, and I bet our listeners would echo this, the main reason we quit hunting quite often is because we've run out of water and we're worried about the dog running out of water, you know?
Yeah.
So why not just add another couple, 3 pounds of water to your pack and call it good?
You know, I use a military analogy. I look at it. I am the support that's in the rear. The dog is on the front lines getting beat up. It's my job to make sure that, number one, that dog is safe and comfortable as I can make him. And if something happens to him, it's my job to get that dog out of the woods to where he can be taken care of. So yeah. I take whatever I think I need, and I have stuff I've carried I've never used, but I still carry it because I might. And some people accuse that of overkill, and maybe it is, but that's what I do.
I joke about it. I tell them, okay, it may seem funny to be carrying all this crap, but there will come a time today when you want some of it.
Yep. That's right, boy. Yeah, my friends have definitely benefited from my carrying first aid gear, that's for sure.
I have a tube of EMT gel that I've never used on one of my dogs, but I've used it on at least 4 other people's dogs.
Right. Yeah. That's the way it often works.
So, you know, you don't have to buy your own beer after a day like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I just stitched up your dog. You're buying beer tonight,
your
by the
turn,
way.
Your turn, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so I've been talking around it, saving it for last, because it, in a way, it's an adventure. I know the feeling. I did the same thing, but not in the world of fiction. But to make room on your plate for writing novels, you have to push something else off the plate. And unfortunately for all of us, it will be a gradual process, but you'll be saying goodbye to us in Gundog Magazine. How do you feel about that?
Well, I had mixed feelings about it. I loved working there under Rick Van Etten. I enjoyed the year that I worked under Callie, my editors at the magazine. I was there a long time. You know, I don't consider myself old, but I'm certainly not a young man anymore. I'm 65, or I will be in a couple of days. And I want to do with the rest of my life the stuff that really matters to me. And I felt like I had a good run at Gundog. I really liked doing what I was doing. They were great. They let me write anything I wanted. I really enjoyed it. I love getting feedback from readers, but it's time for me to do something different. I said everything I had to say. So it's time to explore some new fields and see what happens.
Amen. Congratulations. It's not easy. I fought it too. But very exciting time for you. And I'm just doing the math in my head, which is probably not a good idea, but 16 years at, let's just call it 6 columns a year. That's a whole lot of columns.
That's a lot of columns plus the assignments that they gave me.
Yeah. So yeah, I understand. Yeah. If you had to narrow it down to a few things that you most enjoyed about writing that column, what would they be?
You know what I most enjoyed? Most of my work was for them, and I think this is true with virtually all columnists, was about the nuts and bolts of how to do this, how to do that, how to train a dog. I always tried to put some humor in it. That's sort of my default position. What I really most enjoyed is periodically I would write a piece that dealt more with how I felt about a dog or how I felt about the friends I was hunting with and how the sport, how it impacted me on an emotional level. And those I enjoyed the most. Those were the ones that got the most feedback. Those were the ones that I enjoyed writing. Those were the ones that were basically gave me the same feeling I get when I'm writing fiction. It's like, okay, this, yeah, I wrote about how to steady up a dog and how to do this, and that's important stuff. And I've read 1,000 articles like that to learn myself. But, you know, writing about what you feel and how much you love doing this, that's meaningful work to me. And I got to do that whenever I wanted. So I would do articles like that periodically, and it was always really gratifying, the response that I got.
Well, we're going to miss you in that regard, but we will just have to go to the longer form contributions you make to our lives in the novel format. Leaves on Frozen Ground is your first big break in that world. It's available at Amazon, everybody. That's Dave Carty. Now, just because he's leaving Gundog doesn't mean you won't see him in there for a while. It's, you know, a long process, isn't it, Dave?
I'm not sure exactly what the lead time is, but it's going to be six. They'll probably be running my columns for a few more columns at least. And then they'll have some new lucky guy who gets to work and do what I was doing.
And it's absolutely true. Lucky guy. I know you have served us very well, and on behalf of all of your readers and all of our listeners here at the Upland Nation, thank you for providing us with insights and advice and motivation and all the things that, you know, we need to get somewhere. And that's one of the places we get them. Dave Carty is the author of Leaves on Frozen Ground. That's the first novel out of his head that got published. A fascinating novel full of word pictures and all sorts of twists and turns that I think anybody would enjoy. And there are dogs in there. So
there are dogs.
Among other things, we'll watch for you. We'll keep you close to our hearts. Thanks again for being a part of the Upland Nation and for serving us so well. Dave Carty, hope the rest of your day goes well.
I really appreciate it. This has really been fun. Thanks a lot.
We'll do it again. Maybe we'll do it in the field sometime.
That would be great. I look forward to it.
Thanks again, Dave. Have a great day.
You bet.
But the rest of us are still here, and there's lots more to come, including a public access feature, This Land is Your Land. I'll suggest some places to go toward the end of the season, because you're planning that far ahead, aren't you? I know I am. First, let's talk a little bit about Gunner Kennels. Learn more about them at gunner.com. Man's best kennel, over 1,200 five-star reviews. Watch some of the videos and you'll figure out why. Pretty dramatic. Kids, don't try that at home. Some things to make your life a little bit easier with a Gunner kennel. Free shipping. They also offer financing now. So taking care of your dog and possibly saving your dog's life. A little bit more affordable, a little bit softer on the wallet. Take the Fit Finder quiz or even crowdsource the fit of your Gunner kennel. Learn more at gunner.com. And I know Dave and I and you vicariously have been talking a lot about dog training and stimuli and new places and how to get that dog over the finish line. Well, my secret weapon is the Dogtra T&B dual collar system. Dual collars, two sets of buttons on the handheld transmitter. Put those collars on two dogs, both ends of one dog. It doesn't matter. You've got all of the controls right there. No toggling back and forth. And another thing I love most about this thing is that the beeper is integral to the rest of the unit. Only one little black box on the dog's neck, and it's pointed down so it's not beeping right in your poor dog's ears. You get 10% off if you use the code SLUN10 on anything over $200, and you'll get free shipping as well. SLUN10 for 10% off anything over $200 at dogtra.com. Yeah, I know the season is barely underway for some of you. It's not started for others of us, depending on what you like to shoot at. But today in This Land Is Your Land, brought to you by Huron, South Dakota, where the pheasants outnumber the people, let's talk about the end of the season. You know, a late closing day can be as therapeutic as an early opener, and quite often that means heading south for most of us. Lots of places to go for a later season, longer season, sometimes real deep into February, and in one case, even March. Arizona and New Mexico will let you chase their quails until mid-February. In Texas, at least to the 25th. Georgia and Alabama until about the 28th, thereabouts. Of course, you know, it changes every year, and you want to double-check all of this stuff based on, you know, the calendar to a great degree, but some other things as well. And like I said, in South Carolina, you don't have to stop hunting until March 1st. So if you're looking for somewhere to go to thaw out, maybe a great winter vacation, This Land Is Your Land suggests all of those places. Again, brought to you by Huron, South Dakota. Learn more about the 124,000 acres of public access at hunthuronsd.com. And welcome aboard. Welcome back. Good to have Manning and Joe Exum and Happy Jack Dog Care Products back online with us. They've been a sponsor of the television show for years and years, and now they're part of the whole social media milieu with us as well. Happy Jack Inc. That's happyjackinc.com. Learn more about all of their remedies for skin, coat, parasites, fleas and ticks, and all sorts of other stuff. And I use them all at happyjackinc.com. And ESPAmerica.com is where you learn about remedying in advance your own hearing loss. Yes, indeed. Electronic Shooter's Protection will provide you with protection for your very sensitive eardrum so that you can hear the birds fly, the dog collar tags jingle, and your friends and their bad jokes. It's all at ESPAmerica.com. And that brings us to the end of the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. I want to thank Dave Carty for being a part of our lives and this podcast. Dave has done yeoman's work at Gun Dog Magazine, and I wish you the best, Dave, with your first novel, Leaves on Frozen Ground. Thank you all for listening. If you'd like to talk between now and the next podcast, go to the Wing Shooting USA or the Upland Nation Facebook pages. Do me a favor, will you? Sure could use some more reviews at Apple Podcasts in particular, but wherever you get your podcasts, please leave a positive review. I would thank you in advance for that. Yes, Dave mentioned it, and I will again, because it's so critical that you put a little first aid kit together for both you and your dog and carry it with you on every hunt. Well, I hope you are looking forward to your first or your next hunt. Be safe out there. Thanks again for listening. See you in the field real soon.